Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abual Samad from Navigant Research.
And I'm Rebecca Linland from Rebecca Drives.
And all three of us are also now from Car Review Tweets.
Yes.
That's right.
Twitter Car Reviews. And Rebecca, I know that you have Rebecca Drives, which is kind of the same thing, so...
Rebecca Drives is practically verbose compared to Car Review Tweets.
That's true.
It's 200 words. Car Review Tweets is 280 characters. It's awesome.
Yep. It's a place you can find us. I set it up and, you know, Sam, I know you used it too, but the idea is that it gets that really quick sort of impressions. We're, you know, certainly shooting video and photos and uploading our thoughts on mobile. So it should be something that we keep updated on a pretty regular basis when we get cars, we go to events.
I'll be contributing. I've been so slammed the last 4 weeks. And so I took yesterday and today off.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to get the W-9 and the contract out to you so that we can make sure.
But no, I'll be using it for sure because it plays in really nicely with Rebecca Drives. I mean, it's the same concept of keeping it short, sweet, emotional, giving you just an idea, just a taste. We don't need one more long form review, in my opinion. But
yeah, I agree. And it's sort of the idea was, you know, a lot of times I find myself tweeting threads like that anyway, just as we're discussing cars. So you just get that sort of. It's just a stream of consciousness thing. So anyway, if anybody's wondering about it, if you haven't gone and followed it, you should follow it. It's at TWT Car Reviews. So Twit Car Reviews, and it's called Car Review Tweets, and go there and, you know, interact with us because we crave interaction. We're writers. We're behind keyboards. Sam's frozen in his dungeon right now. Why don't I throw it to you, Sam? What are you driving or trying to drive? Or what are you digging out of the snow?
Well, before it snowed, I had the Volvo XC60 again, the T6, which I quite like, although I'm still waiting on my opportunity to get into the V60, that's the Volvo I really want, is the V60.
I had the V60. Yeah, I had that a couple weeks ago. It's nice. It's cushy and comfortable and looks good.
Yeah. And, you know, the XC60 is you know, equally cushy and comfortable and, to my eyes at least, doesn't look quite as good. You know, it's taller. I mean, it's a crossover version of the same thing. It's built on that same platform. You know, and, you know, the current Volvo design language, I think, you know, looks really awesome. I've liked it in, you know, pretty much everything they've done over the last several years. You know, interior, you know, as we've discussed, you know, ad nauseum on numerous occasions, is, you know, is a lovely place to spend time, aside from that whole census UI thing. But, you know, and we don't need to beat that dead horse again. But that even that's something that's going to be replaced next year, starting with the XC40 electric that's coming next year. Volvo is going to start rolling out an all new infotainment system that's built on Android Automotive, that replaces the Sensus system, and, you know, gets rid of that whole concept of swiping, you know, between the three screens. You know, it's going to be more concentrated just on the one central screen, I think. The T6 version is the mid level version that has the supercharged and turbocharged 4-cylinder, 2-liter 4-cylinder with 315 horsepower. And, you know, it's a lovely engine. One of my favorite aspects of the XC60 is the massaging seats, which I find to be very helpful at times, you know, especially after I've been working in the yard, raking up leaves for several hours.
I like how you can control the passenger seat from Sensus, so you can surprise people.
Yeah.
Like,
that is one upside of, you know, of having all that stuff embedded in the screen, is you can do things like that. On the other hand, the passenger can do the same thing to the driver, which, yeah, perhaps not so nice.
Yeah, that's true.
I will say, and I'll talk about it more in the next podcast, but I happen to have the XC40 this week, and I had to drive out to Pennsylvania, pick something up, and bring it back home. And it was 7 hours in the car with basically like a half hour break. And I would have killed for massaging seats at about hour five because those seats were getting hard. But that's for next week.
Yeah, well, so that's when you stop and you get some ibuprofen and you chew it. So that it just...
That's when you stop and get some.
Yeah, no, I suffer. You know, to be fair, I think there's not too many cars that you can do that long in the saddle and not have some fatigue, maybe even with massaging. Because I had... we did Manhattan back in the Cadillac XT6. And even that, with its nice seats... after a while, you just start to get sore. You get those pressure points. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was surprisingly good. But again, I'll talk about that next week. I don't want to give it away. So go on, just, Sam. Tell us.
Yeah,
more.
Sam. Did it have the crystal shift knob?
It did not. That's only on the plug-in hybrids. So the non-hybrid versions still retain this mechanical shift lever. You know, that goes back and forth. So it's not even an electronic shifter. It's a mechanical one.
Did it just go
straight forward and back.
How do you feel about that one?
Compared to the electronic shifter that's on the plug-in hybrids, I actually prefer it. Because I find it more consistent. For the electronic ones on the Volvos, you actually have to tap it twice to go from, you know, to switch, like to go from park to reverse or park to drive. You know, you've got to, if you tap it only once, it goes to neutral.
I know.
And I don't like that.
So I got to tell you, when I picked up the Volvo on Friday from LaGuardia, I thought I was going to have to call somebody because I couldn't get it into drive. I was like.
Oh, because you were just doing it once?
No, I didn't know that I needed to like move it over.
Oh, okay.
And it was very annoying. And I have a very funny story that I won't tell right now about Volvos and me and gear selectors. But I didn't have that same issue in the XC90, though. I do remember tapping it twice for sure.
The non-hybrid XC90s, again, don't have that electronic shifter. They have a mechanical shifter.
Okay. So that's why it was so much easier.
Yeah. It's only the plug-in hybrids that have that.
But mine was a plug-in hybrid.
Well, the 90?
Yes. Remember, because somebody chewed me out for not mentioning that. So it was definitely the XC. It was definitely the plug-in hybrid. But maybe I just got used to it. I mean, I'm used to the XC40 now, but it definitely takes practice.
It does. And, you know, I mean, if you actually owned one and, you were driving it for more than a week at a time, you would certainly get accustomed to all this stuff. Being a Swedish car, a premium Swedish vehicle, you know, this thing, you know, of course, also has all the kinds of things that work, you know, would be handy. It would have been handy to have this week, when we got our first, you know, Arctic blast here in Michigan. You know, with as I speak right now, I think the temperature is down to about 14 or 15 degrees, and it's supposed to go down to 5 degrees sometime during the night. We got 8 inches of snow yesterday. So, you know, it would have been nice to have the heated wiper blades with integral washers instead of what I have right now. This one, also has the, the four corner air suspension, so you can lift it, raise it up and lower it down, you know, it does give it definitely improved ride quality. There's a really nice heads up display. So, you know, it's overall, you know, modern Volvos are they're a really wonderful place to spend time, you know, when you've got to get from one place to another. You know, the seats are comfortable. I like everything about it, really.
One thing I love is that they have different levels of heat. in the seat and in the steering wheel. And I had to laugh because when I had mine on the high level and I didn't have any gloves on, it was hot. But then, of course, I realized that, like, if you have gloves on, this is going to be amazing.
And, you know, of course, you know, you can also turn them off separately. So once your wheel is nice and warm, you know, you can just switch that off.
Yes.
You know, the price point on the one I was driving, you know, because it was pretty loaded. It was the Inscription model. And, you know, it was just shy of $66,000 delivered, which is, you know, it's not inexpensive. But, you know, for a premium, you know, for a vehicle in this segment, you know, you compare it to an Audi or BMW or Mercedes, you know, it's quite competitive. And, you know, got decent fuel economy. You know, it's 24 miles per gallon, you know, for a 316 horsepower four-wheel drive SUV. It's not bad at all.
So here's my sort of issue with the XC60 is that it's the mid, sort of like the midsize of their range. It's just not, it's not that roomy, you know, and it's, I know what it's supposed to do and it sort of fills that niche, but really if you need it for cargo space, you really should buy the XC90.
That's probably a valid concern. You know, I guess it depends a lot on, you know, what your needs are. You know, I mean, if you've got, you know, a couple of kids that you're hauling around and all their stuff, you know, that you probably want something a little bigger than this.
Yeah. With a trailer and a roof box.
Yeah.
But that
put the kids in the trailer and, you know, all the other stuff in the roof box and you're good to go. Yeah.
But you're right.
Ernie, put the kids in
a nice serene trip.
The XC90 holds a lot.
But it does.
I think the XC60 though is, it's kind of that nice balance between, I mean, it's, I know what it's supposed to be between the XC40 and the XC90, because the XC40, it's pretty compact and it's very much of a personal vehicle. And I think the XC60 is that nice transition.
The 40 is clearly
household, couple, one kid maybe.
Yeah, the 40 is definitely more, you know, for the urban environment, you know, where you want something that's smaller and easier to park.
Right.
You know, I think the 60 is, you know, a really, you know, not too big, not too small, just right, you know, nice balance of, you know, decent size. And like I said before, you know, personally, if I was spending the money, I would go for the V60. I have no desire to own, you know, a higher up SUV. It's just not something I like. You know, I will always take the station wagon over the SUV if I have an option. You know, if you've got to spend some time in a vehicle on the road, you know, this is not a bad place to spend your time.
So, but how does it actually drive though? That's the other thing is, taken on its own, it behaves well enough. I didn't really have a ton of complaints about the V60, for instance, but compared to its competitive set, you know, BMW and Mercedes,
it's not a sports sedan or, you know, it's not a sports car. You know, and I think, you know, compared to a BMW, you know, dynamically, it's probably not, I would say it's not quite as good dynamically.
Although some of the latest BMWs are not quite as good either.
That's true. The steering is precise, if not necessarily, you know, providing a whole lot of feedback. You know, everything generally feels good. You know, it feels like you're in control. You know, the all wheel drive system, you know, definitely, you know, helps in low traction conditions, you know, when it's raining, you know, when you get some heavy rain, it definitely comes in handy. You know, we did actually get a little bit of snow last week. You know, we got our first snowfall, on the last day I had this last week. And, you know, it was definitely nice to have a little all wheel drive to get warmed up in the first snow of the season. But, you know, I think that for the customer that's looking for something like this, you know, they're going to be very happy with this.
Yeah, I couldn't argue with that, I suppose. But I will. My final gripe with both the XC60 and the XC90 is the way they ride. With the air suspension especially, I just felt like they're They're not supple enough, you know, but the V60, which is on the same platform, didn't seem to have so much of an issue. It was actually pretty good. And the S60 as well seems to have that balance, at least with steel springs. So I don't know whether it's the air suspension or something. It's just,
when you put it in dynamic mode, you know, it definitely feels stiffer. You know, if you put it in, I think it's the comfort mode or, you know, it does soften up. It is noticeably softer.
And there's a noticeable difference between the modes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you know? Definitely.
I think that the thing with Volvo is it's also for people who just want something a little bit different and a little bit different aesthetic also. You know, when you think about like BMWs and Audis and Mercedes, they're, you know, the design aesthetic is just different. And there's, and it's not that they're common, but you do see them more. I feel like Volvo is just that little bit of different mindset for a consumer.
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of marching to a slightly different drummer, you know, a different beat than the Germans. And you know, it's good to have choices.
Yeah,
they, exactly. And they are very popular. They have a lot of presence in certain areas. And, you know, pockets where they're popular, they continue to be popular. I think they've very successfully transitioned from what they, you know, pretty aging lineup, say, back in 2013.
that's putting it mildly.
but, you know, that was a good lineup. You know, everything had a real family vibe to it that really sort of all came out in the first few years of the, you know, the first decade of the 2000s, you know, between 2000 and 2005 or six.
Actually, the original XC90 goes back to, I think, about 98.
2003, but it was in development all the way back. Yeah, it goes back to, so it was the S80 came out in 98, and the original XC90 is based on that S80. And you can still buy that architecture over in your Ford store.
Not for long.
Not for long.
They've ended production of the Flex and the Lincoln MKT. So,
but the Taurus is still around.
And no, barely. It's been out of production for a while too.
Really? Oh,
and I didn't there's still some in inventory probably, but yeah, they ended production of that early this year. When they switched over to, you know, to getting set up for the new Explorer and Aviator.
Oh, maybe it's all done now because the Explorer. Yeah. It was Taurus, Explorer, Flex,
And MKT.
And MKT. I forgot about the MKT, which you should too.
The other thing too with Volvo,
the market certainly did. You know, at least 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I think the XC90 came out in like 2002 timeframe. Yeah. But then, of course, they were owned by Ford. But then, you know, the transition to ownership by Geely was really significant. And I may have told the story before, but I was over in Göteborg like just days, weeks before they were going to be purchased. And the people were really, really nervous. I mean, they had, you know, legitimate concerns about Geely owning them. And then I went a year later and it was just a completely different vibe. They were thrilled. They said that they're just like leaving them alone, giving them the money to do what they want to do. And it was just people were really genuinely, genuinely happy at Volvo headquarters. And
yeah. I mean, Geely has been an incredible steward of the brands that it has acquired over the last several years.
Yes, particularly a very good Volvo. Way to put it. Yeah, for sure.
Now, do they own Lotus too?
They do now. Yeah. They bought Lotus and also a controlling stake in Proton.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't wait for the first Lotus tuned suspension on a Volvo. I think that'll fix it. That'll solve all my complaints. But they've been really careful, and I think that's important because a lot of times you see ownership that's not careful, and that's sort of more damaging. And I think that's a legitimate concern when you've got that sort of cultural clash of leadership and ownership. We've seen or we've heard lots of comments about how, you know, difficult it is to do business or to work for, you know, Hyundai and Kia, for example.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not a Korean, you know, working and you work at Hyundai or Kia, It can be, especially you know, in the executive ranks, it can be challenging.
And even if you are Korean, it can be challenging.
That's true.
It doesn't matter.
But yeah, I mean, Americans, you know, in the executive ranks at Hyundai and Kia, generally tend not to have the longest tenures. Although I do know a number of people who've been at Hyundai of America for more than a decade now, and you know, seem to be doing quite well. So,
well, we can ask John Krafcik about his time there.
Well, I mean, he had one of the longer tenures as CEO of that brand in North America. And, you know, nobody else has lasted as long as he did.
It was the fuel economy thing that took him out, right? He sort of fell on his sword for that. There was something. Or maybe it was just his time to leave and it happened.
Yeah. I think it was more the latter.
Yeah. He probably wouldn't admit to it anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on from the XC90 or XC60, which is a perfect snow car. You know, Rebecca, the 2020 Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross also strikes me as kind of a pretty good snow car. And that's probably
at least on paper.
Yeah. That's about the only time I'm ever going to call it like a pretty good anything car. That thing's fine. And that's about as much as you can say. It's so old and I don't know.
But it just came out.
I respect Mitsubishi for how long they've been able to stretch that, but that car is just not real good.
It's not. And actually, you know, I had one back in the spring, so we may have spoken about the 2019. I definitely wrote a review about it. But this was the 2020 version of the Eclipse Cross SEL. Has a 1.5 liter engine in it, 4-cylinder.
Oh, that engine. I remember liking that engine a lot, actually. I thought the engine was pretty good.
Okay, maybe.
It was
better when I took it out of econ mode. Econ mode was brutal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
It was like it was wrapped in cotton. Like it just, I was like, please start moving. And it was so lethargic and listless and just this like really muffled, like you put your foot on the accelerator and absolutely nothing happened.
Yeah. See, maybe, I don't know. I'm not sure what I experienced where I was going to say, like, I felt like it was a larger displacement and something. I don't know. It felt more energetic than I thought it should for 1.5.
Well, but, so this was, yeah, I mean, it is turbocharged. And as I said, and the CVT, you know, I struggle with CVTs anyway, but it just, I mean, once I got it out of econ, and I basically left it out of econ because I couldn't stand it. But, you know, I, like you said, like, I mean, I give Mitsubishi credit and I want them to do well because there's really
too.
Good people that work there.
So that's what makes me feel so guilty for pointing out like these are just not good cars. Cause they come and they support us. They sponsor some events sometimes and stuff. And
yeah,
this is, like you said, they're good people and they try hard. And
they're good people. They really are. It's just, you know, but at the end of the day, it's always about the product, right? And so, you know, and this Mitsubishi, the Eclipse Cross, it's the base is $28,595 for the version that I had. And then it had some different features in it that including like heated seats and some driver assist things. And then it got up to like 32.7 delivered. And I think that it just, you know, I remember things like I couldn't get the voice recognition to work. Like I would press it and my phone was attached. My phone was connected, but it gave me some random message. I can't remember now what it was. I should have recorded it. And then it said it again. And I was like, okay. So then, of course, I had to make a phone call. So then, of course, I end up having to use my phone, not on Bluetooth, because I couldn't get it to work, even though it was connected. Like, it was just, I couldn't make the phone call through voice recognition. And then I couldn't change the radio. And there's no dials because voice recognition wasn't working.
And yeah, it's got you got to use the touch screen. There are no
right.
Yeah, Is that like the Rockford Fosgate branded head unit still?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Looks like it has a touchpad in there too.
It does.
Just what every car should have.
Touchpad is pointless.
I didn't. So that was a bit of a memorable moment. And then as I'm driving on the Merritt Parkway, which is a lovely two-lane highway, and I drive it a lot, and there's a particular bump, but it's not like a pothole. It's like two bumps in the road as if they repaired it or something, and then it sort of frost heaved a little bit. And I try and avoid the bump because I know where it is, but in this particular case, I wasn't able to, and I hit it, and I swear if I had had dentures, they would have come out. Like, this was just – and in no other car does it do this, like, because I've hit it before. You know, it's not so huge that I'm going to make an evasive maneuver around it, but – man, I think I actually hit it in the Volvo XC40, and it was nothing like that. And I remember thinking, wow, what a difference it was between, you know, going over this particular patch versus in one car versus the other. And, you know, for $32,000, there's so many other vehicles in this class, in that five passenger, four door, mid to compact SUV size that you could buy for that price. It just,
yeah, the world really is your oyster at that price level. First of all, like, you've got the SEL, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that's an all wheel drive version. Cause there's I'm looking at what's available for 2020. It seems like there's a new two wheel drive option. So you can actually get it probably a little cheaper than your SEL starts. So it's got to start in the 20s. But even there, like, what I found with it was when you start to compare, features for price, the Eclipse Cross does pretty well, like Sam said, on paper.
Yes.
You know, it has a lot of features. It has a head-up display.
It
checks off all the boxes.
It does. And so I can understand how it makes that case for itself. I think, like you found, it's a much more primitive chassis.
Yeah.
Than pretty much everything else. But
it's an IIHS.
It does okay.
It's an IIHS top safety pick too.
Yeah, so
really try.
It has active, some active safety features too.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure. Yeah, this one has
collision mitigation.
The lane departure warning. It had adaptive cruise. Heated steering wheel, heated front and rear seats, that Rockford Fosgate premium sound system, and all of that for $2,100. A huge power panoramic sunroof. I mean, it should be a good value, but I think part of it too is there's just so much competition that it has to be really good, and it's not.
Yeah, it's not as polished. Materials aren't as good,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, you know, again, I wanted to like it. I wanted to be like, okay, good. This is great. And also the visibility out the back is not great. It just, you know, I just struggled with it.
Well, it's got that funky sort of Aztec style rear window, right?
Yes.
Where there's a bar right across the middle of the mirror where exactly where you want to see.
Exactly where you need it to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was unfortunate.
I hope eventually Mitsubishi gets some new platforms, because this is the same sort of leftovers they've been dealing with. And I part of it is just they don't have anything else right
now. Do they have alliances? I don't know if they have.
They're part of the Renault-Nissan alliance.
The Renault-Nissan alliance. Yeah, but that, I mean, I don't know.
But they're also lashed up with Toyota with something too, right?
No, they're not.
No, you're right. I forgot they were part of the Nissan-Renault alliance. Okay. So
yeah,
hopefully better products are on the way, because they do deserve it. You know, I think that they could be a competitive brand. I'm concerned because they're offering 0% financing for 48 months, and they got into trouble, you know, years ago with their too many zeros,
I remember sitting next to, I won't name any names, but I remember sitting next to a PR guy from Mitsubishi and saying, oh, hey, how did that 000 thing work out for you? And he was like, it was awful. It was the worst thing ever. Cause it's like a sugar high for the brand. It temporarily juiced sales, but they were selling cars that were
It was all subprime stuff too.
Yeah. And yeah. Exactly. And it was people who couldn't even swing it on the sort of most generous, somewhat predatory and abusive terms. And so the cars came back.
I know. It didn't help him. I will say though, he was a great guy though, because he knew I had tickets to the LA Kings game and the hockey match, and we were in a meeting, and he looked at the time and he goes, you have to go if you're going to get there on time.
Oh, that's awesome. But yeah, it's just, you know, I hope they don't fall down that trap, and I hope they get some better product. I mean, Nissan has a bunch of stuff already that they could just sort of give them.
Well, and that's what we're going to start seeing, you know, and the Mitsubishi joined the alliance just 2 years ago.
Right.
They were struggling, and Nissan and Renault stepped in and took a controlling interest. And, you know, the next batch of vehicles, the next batch of new vehicles, you know, are going to be adopting, you know, platforms from the alliance.
I mean, you know what? They can just sell Renaults with Mitsubishi badges here, and I'd be fine with that, because there's so many interesting cars. and probably some of it is like the forbidden fruit kind of thing. Like, we don't have it here, but the French cars are fascinating to me. Mitsubishi has such a history too. That's the thing that kills me.
You could replace the Mirage with the Zoe.
Yeah. I mean, just, I think back like to the, you know, the 90s, sort of the Japanese bubble economy certainly helped them out, but they had the Diamante was just this.
The first generation Diamante was actually quite a neat vehicle.
Yeah, exactly. And then they had the Galant that looked very similar. They had all the Diamond Star cars, which were amazing. The 3000 GT, like, they were on a roll. And let's not forget the Lancer Evo. And I don't know, they've been an engineering sort of powerhouse for a long time. I mean,
they were great at engines for a long time.
Yeah, they had that little
not so great on the chassis side, but they were great at engines.
You see that, and it's even as sort of limited as we're saying the Eclipse Cross is, like, for its limitations, it drives well enough, if I recall. Like, it drives okay. It drives fine. It's you don't get any surprises. Right?
It drives it's fine. Exactly.
Stable.
And, I mean, I didn't feel unsafe in it by any stretch. You know, I didn't feel like I didn't have control over the vehicle or that the steering was imprecise or something. It's not a sport, you know, it's not an athletic, refined product. But, you know, it's just...
the groan says it all. Poor Mitsubishi.
So on a happier note, the other one that I had...
Yeah.
I had the Fiat 124 Spider, which, of course,
the Fiata.
Right. I was going to say the Fiata.
Exactly. The Fiata. And I actually, I didn't get a lot of chance to drive it because I was traveling, and Saturday I had to do the marathon gumball rally out to Pennsylvania. But I had the top down, which was a lot of fun on Monday, and it was beautiful out and zipped around in it. And, you know, I will say, though, it was really interesting because it was not as engaging as the Miata. Like,
well, it's about 100 pounds heavier than a Miata.
Okay. Yeah.
But it also has the turbo engine.
The extra body work does add some weight to it.
It does. And the Miata that I had was a manual, which is so much fun. And this is an automatic. And there's just something really authentic about the Miata that the Fiata doesn't give you. At the same time, I thought the styling, you know, the styling is beautiful. It's such a head turner. And I was able to get in and out of both cars fairly easily, but this one was really easy to get out of. Like, I was really surprised. And then I had a friend of mine that came with me, and he's a pretty big guy. And he was like, how am I going to fold myself into this? this. And I was like, well, just try it. And the next thing you knew, he was in it. And I was like, oh, that was really easy. And so, you know, there was just things that was really pleasant about it. Of course, the exhaust note with the Abarth engine was just incredible. I mean, it's really fun. So, you know, just hearing that alone, the heated seats were great. It did not have a heated steering wheel, which I was disappointed about. And I actually had trouble with the Uconnect system, which is typically really well received, but it didn't seem to like my USB-C connection. And I definitely had some issues with it. Not as much as the Mitsubishi, but I was just surprised because usually the Uconnect is really reliable.
Well, doesn't the 124 just have the standard Mazda infotainment system in it?
Oh.
The last one I drove did.
You know what? I think you're right because it's not touchscreen either. It wasn't touch, which I discovered.
Does it have the little control knob down on the console?
Yeah, it's got a central controller.
Yes, it does. Yeah. No, you're right. Because I couldn't get it to move. I was like, why won't this do? And my friend's like, because it's not touchscreen. I'm like, oh, right. Okay.
See, and I think that's...
it has the proper interface for an in-vehicle.
No, it does not.
No, I think that they really should have a touchscreen on it as well as the controller. Because even though I like using
the controller... No
touchscreens. And it's... I don't know. Again... you got to meet the people where they are. If you're going to put the screen in the thing, you have to just understand that people are going to touch the screen. I can't tell you how many fingers I have resisted breaking in my career as a video editor, where people reach out and they touch your monitor, and you need the monitor clean. You don't want smudges on it. And it's just, it's the touch screens drive me bonkers. But if you're going to have the thing, people are going to want to touch it.
Yes. I wanted to touch it. I touched it and touched it, and it wouldn't work. But again, you know, this vehicle is just, it's so much fun for, you know, meandering drives and just classic automotive experience. I mean, this one, and again, it has a pretty decent trunk, almost no space inside. It doesn't even have a glove box. But the top is so easy to put up and down. You know, it's just, there's such a simplistic authenticity to the driving experience when you're in a two-door, two-passenger roadster. And I know, Sam, you have an amazing Miata that I've driven in, and it just has that same feel that is often lost today. So I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and compared to mine, you know, the modern Miatas and the 124, you know, feel so much more solid. And what's amazing is, at least in the Miata version, you know, it actually weighs almost the same as my first generation one, but you know, mine feels practically delicate by comparison, you know, whereas this one, you know, the modern ones, you know, it feels really nice and solid.
It does.
You know, and of course, you know, you also, it's got a higher belt line, so you feel more enclosed. You don't feel quite as exposed as you do in mine. You know, mine, you know, the belt line is lower, you know, I can stick my arm out, you know, and my arm's not, you know, if I put my arm on the windowsill, you know, and the new one, you know, it's definitely angled up more.
Right.
Whereas, you know, it's much more comfortable in mine, but nonetheless, you know, they are great to drive. And, you know, I drove the 124 about a year and a half ago, but I had the Abarth, with the 6-speed manual.
Oh, and, that's, you know, nice.
That 1.4 liter turbo with the 6-speed manual is a fantastic combination.
I bet that's
the only way. Is that the only way to get a manual with the 124?
No.
Oh, no, you can get it with the other trims.
You can get it in all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. So this one goes for about just over 37,000, 37,020. It does have the Recaro seats and a couple of other additions, but it was just a lot of fun. I mean, I didn't want to see it go, for sure. I definitely could have had it.
Does it feel more worth it than the Miata?
The
starting price is pretty similar. You know, the pricing is not that different between the Fiat and the Mazda.
Yeah, I mean, I preferred the Mazda overall, I would say. The handling of it was a little bit crisper. I just felt like there was really good feedback from the steering. And again, you know, part of it, I'm sure, was because it was a manual that I just was so much more engaged with it. I loved it. I mean, I felt like I was always conscious of what I was driving in the Miata because it was just something that I wanted to communicate with. Whereas the 124 was a little bit more, almost well-behaved, if you will. Like, I felt like I could get myself into a lot of trouble.
A little more grown up. Yeah, the Fiat feels a little more grown up.
Yes, yes. I mean, I felt like with the Miata, I felt like I really could, I could do some damage in that thing. it was a lot of fun. But yes, you're exactly right, Sam. The Fiat is, it's a little bit more grown up. It's not that it's more refined. It's just more serious somehow.
Yeah, To the question of the engines, there's actually only the 1.4 liter turbo offered in the Fiat now.
Seems like
there used to be another engine option, but now it's just the 1.4 turbo.
And then on the pricing, the Miata that I had this summer was $38,335, and the Fiat is $37,020. I don't know if they're exactly the same, but and actually the Fiat, I think it's like the automatic is like a $1,300 or $1,400 upcharge. So
yeah, because you should not buy it.
Exactly.
it's $1,350 for the automatic.
See? They charge you what you could get a whole used Miata for just a transmission that you shouldn't buy anyway. Don't buy that transmission.
Yeah, but you know what? If you find a $1,300 Miata, walk away from it.
I didn't say it wasn't going to be $1,300 worth of regret. I just said it was like you can get one.
Is it $1,300 that Miata is probably going to be mostly just rust holding it together.
And there are people who legitimately can't drive manuals. You get knee problems and whatever like that. That's a thing. So carry on, do your thing. You spend the money on the transmission. But I personally would just be like, no. I'm saving that money. Put it into gas.
Totally agree with you.
But you know, you can get the 124 for the Classico model starting at 25.4, and you know that's got that 1.4 turbo, you know, manual transmission. You know, and that's actually a really nice combination.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and again, that's one of the fun things about that. These types of vehicles is that if they have that lower price point, you don't necessarily need it all dolled up. You know, you don't need it all spiffed up. It's just a fun car to drive.
See now, and I kind of, my assumption is, and I haven't really compared them side by side. My assumption is that the Fiat feels a little bit more dressed up interior wise. Certainly styling is slightly different, but
in the cabin, the only difference between the Fiat and the Mazda is the badge on the steering wheel on the airbag.
Yeah, so
everything else is exactly the same, and the graphic that comes up when the infotainment starts up, you know, you get a 124 profile on there versus the Mazda graphic that comes up.
Can you get the Recaro seats and the Alcantara leather suede with the Miata?
I believe you can get Recaros.
Okay, but I don't know if
I'm not 100%
I didn't mention
sure.
it in my review, so I usually would have done, but I'll look it up too and see. Because I thought the interior was I mean, certainly the seats were just beautiful, you know. So I think they did a good job. Overall, it was a lot of fun.
I think when you compare, you can see I think the original Spider was the 124 was styled by Michelotti.
Mm.
And I think you can see how much they tried. To get some of that into the current car.
Yeah, there's definitely cues, you know, of that original 124 in this new one.
Yeah, I think they did an okay job. It's different, and you know what? I don't care that it's a Miata. I think it's good that we have choices.
Yeah.
So exactly.
Well, you know, the funny thing is the 124 originally was when Fiat and Fiat Chrysler and Mazda first got together for this program. This was actually supposed to be an Alfa Romeo Spider, not a Fiat.
Yes.
Sergio Marchionne had decreed that all Alfas would be built in Italy. And Mazda said, you know, for the kind of volume you're going to have for this thing, it makes zero sense to build it, you know, to add a second line in Italy to build it. And so they said, you know, so it only makes economic sense if we build it in Japan. And so they, you know, they decided, okay, fine, we'll make it a Fiat instead.
It's the best Fiat there is.
And it's one of the only Fiats in the States anymore. So
I really like the 500X too. But
yeah. What did you drive this week?
I was going to say, very much like Sam, I was tooling around in a premium compact. Well, it seems Sam's isn't compact, but I had the 2020 Ford Escape Titanium. This is my first experience with the new Escape, this is the third generation. So it's the only way you're going to get.
It's actually fourth generation.
Is it fourth? How's it fourth generation? You had two generations of the first one, one generation of the second.
Well, technically, the second, there was the second generation that launched in 2009
or something. Yeah. So yeah, that was a really heavy mid-cycle refresh to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was the same. It was the same basic platform, but, all the bodywork, all the interior was completely redone.
I loved that generation.
The second gen?
Yeah. It was just such a friendly, little, honest little crossover. And with the 3-liter V6, it was plenty of, you know, had plenty of power. They made a hybrid version of it. It drove really well because it was a Mazda. it's just like, there was very little to complain about. I think Ford really nailed it. And then when they went to the outgoing Escape, the 2019 is the one that replaced that, the one that I was just speaking rapturously about. And I just never warmed up to it. It just felt clunky on its feet. It was bigger, but it didn't feel bigger. It drove more bland. Some of that's probably just rose colored glasses. I didn't like the styling. It never warmed the recesses of my heart like that other Escape. And so I really wanted to try this latest generation. So I'll agree with you. I'll say it's the fourth generation. And it's the only way you're going to get the newest Ford Focus here in the States, because we don't get it any other way. And it's good. You know, it's certainly the basic architecture is real good. And I discovered that, especially if you want to drive it at the limit, the Focus bits really help. And it reacts surprisingly well to being flung really hard until the stability control kicks in and decides that you have much too much of a yaw angle happening and you need to settle down. Straightens it out and stops.
In theory, you mean?
Yeah, in theory, right. No, that wasn't a clover leaf that I really, really cranked in and a bunch of steering angle at the end of it. Nope.
Not at all.
Not a thing that happened.
Nope.
But it, you know, it's a solid platform. It's an all new platform, so it that pays dividends. It's got the 2-liter EcoBoost, which is plenty powerful for what it is. The styling inside and out, it's hard not to like the titanium. It's the highest trim level, so it's nice. Inside, I really love what they've done with the interior. They've cleaned it up quite a bit. It looks a lot better, especially again in the most premium trim. There's like a strip of it's faux wood, but it looks real nice. It's kind of a low gloss thing, emulates what you'd see in a more higher end interior like in the Volvo. So they did a nice job with that. The ergonomics are cleaned way up because there were a lot of buttons on the outgoing. On the 2019, it has a ton of little buttons and they're kind of haphazard. It's a lot better organized in the 2020. Some of the buttons are still kind of small and it's hard to operate them by feel, and they're all the way at the base of the console. So your best bet is probably to just leave the HVAC in auto and you won't have any of the complaints that I had, but I'm, you know, I like to tinker. So I had some trouble finding some of the controls for a couple of days until I got used to it. And Sync 3 is better. it's not perfect. The voice recognition actually really does help you out. That's again, I think probably the best way to operate the whole system. I was a little disappointed that by using CarPlay, I was stuck with using maps, where I would have much rather used the embedded nav in some cars. Like I had the Honda Passport. I had CarPlay connected, but I could use the built-in nav, which I preferred, versus using maps on my phone. But overall, it's a solid update. There's a lot to like about it. It is $40,000, so it starts to creep up there price-wise, but it's the top trim. So it has all the toys. It's got the leather. It's got the big panoramic roof. It's got the power hatch, all the ADAS stuff. You can get it, I think, in the mid-20s.
It starts at about 25.
Yeah, so that's a much more reasonable deal for it. You don't need the titanium trim. Again, it looks real nice, but you don't need it. So I was a little disappointed in the ergonomics. I still was struck by how much sort of more refined the RAV4 felt. And, you know, the Escape's not bad, but just the RAV4 felt a little more rigid, had a little bit better suspension discipline. And, you know, the interior of the Ford is nicer, but I also had the RAV4 XSE. So it's different. It's not apples to apples. I think the RAV4 is actually a little larger, a little roomier. It's at least more upright. So this is a lot more stylish, but I think you pay for that a little bit. Although I was able to fit a nice chunk of lawn equipment in the back of it on Saturday. It's a good choice. It's a good compact crossover. It's a great update for what they had. Fuel economy is a little disappointing, and it only came in at about 24. You could spend the extra 20 grand and get the XC60 that Sam had and get the same fuel economy with more space.
You can also get the 1.5 liter three-cylinder turbo in here as the base engine, and that's nice engine too.
I would love to have that. It just has that little snarly engine note. That's so much more entertaining, because the 2 liter, it's powerful, it's fine, but it also, it's not as muted. I'm sure the Corsair is a lot quieter, but you hear some of the engine note. I do like that it doesn't have a CVT. It has a conventional automatic, and those are really well matched to each other. And if you put it in eco mode, everything calms down a bit, and it smooths out your inputs, so it's not snapping your head around. Like the brakes are touchy, the gas pedal's touchy, in some of the other modes. It's a really, really good entry to the compact crossover.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the EPA fuel economy numbers. You know, the 2 liter, the all wheel drive 2 liter is rated at 26 combined. The front wheel drive 1.5 is at 30, and the hybrids, the all wheel drive hybrid is at 40 miles per gallon and 41 for the front drive hybrid.
See, so, the front drive hybrid is the one to get.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're looking for, you know, for fuel economy, you know, the hybrid really is the way to go. And, you know, having driven both the hybrid and the titanium with the 2 liter, you know, the hybrid is not quite as powerful, but it's still, you know, it's got plenty of power. You know, it's over 200 horsepower combined for the hybrid powertrain. And, you know, that's more than sufficient. And, you know, I think the thing to keep in mind about, you know, what they've done with the Escape this time around, you know, because Ford is expanding their SUV lineup, you know, they've shifted where the Escape kind of sits in the lineup. You know, in the past, you know, it was, they were trying to have it be more of an SUV, you know, and kind of, you know, be, you know, this urban suburban commuter vehicle, and also, you know, kind of have some semblance of off-road capability. And this time they have shifted the Escape to really be more of, you know, that suburban commuter vehicle. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the Escape, you know, when we were at the launch, they said that I think it's like about 2/3 of Escape buyers are women.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
You know, and you know, the way it gets used, you know, regardless of who the buyer is, you know, it really is more of that urban suburban, you know, commuting vehicle. It essentially is, you know, really, you know, the way people traditionally would use a car like the Focus. And it has this new Escape has definitely shifted to be more Focus like, you know, and, you know, taller, but still Focus like. And, you know, then to fill that gap, you know, for those that want something a little more rugged, they have this other variant that's on the same platform that's coming, you know, that has been referred to as, you know, the baby Bronco or the Bronco Sport or something like, you know, it'll be something like that. You know, that's coming. Yeah, that's coming in the spring, and that's going to be targeted more, you know, as a rugged off-road vehicle. You know, so think of it more like, you know, like a Cherokee Trailhawk type of vehicle.
Okay.
Yeah. I do that too.
Yeah. I think that the key for the Escape, it seems, is that when it's at its most pure, when they just own what it is, it's better. You know, I liked it the most when it was a trucklet, you know, and now I like it more now when it's, like you said, sort of embracing fully that role as a urban commuter, just what you would use a Focus for, but in crossover form, because people want crossovers versus what is, you know, the 2019 is a little confused. It's kind of in between. It doesn't quite know. And it doesn't do either as well as, you know, this one does being a crossover, and the old one did at being a little truck. So,
yeah. And, you know, one of the things I really do like about this new one, you know, is that they have, you know, they've done things like lowered the belt line. You know, the visibility out of this one is so much better than in the old one. You know, all around, to the front and to the sides and to the rear. You know, it's, you can see better out of this thing. The pillars are slimmer than before. You know, one of the issues with the old one was, you know, it had really thick A pillars, and, you know, the way the mirrors were mounted at the base of the A pillars, and then from inside, you know, the A pillars curved inwards at the bottom. So you had this massive blind spot at the base of the A pillars on the old one, and that's much reduced now on the new version.
Yeah, I hated being in the last one.
Well, A pillars are always an issue for me, being short and how close I put the seat.
That me too.
Right. That A pillar just becomes bigger and bigger, you know, as you inch towards the steering wheel. And I remember on the launch that I thought the Escape had really, really good visibility, and it was nice to drive. I mean, it wasn't the most exciting car, but again, this segment is really, it's kind of for everybody, and it has a wide range of appeal. I do agree, Sam. I think that Escape buyers are probably women, because it's a nice size, you know, and it's a nice price point. It's a good sense of feel, and it's not very exciting. You know, you're not going to get into a competition with somebody at a traffic light because it's not all souped up. We drove the hybrid as well, and that was really nice. They did a really, really good job on the hybrid too. It was not very intrusive. You know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, you're driving a hybrid. The regen brakes were really well behaved. And I like this lineup. I think they have something for everybody.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing they've done in the lineup now is, you know, if you look at it, you know, you've got the base S model, the SE, and then there's the hybrid. The first hybrid trim level is the SE Sport Hybrid. So, you know, they've actually made the hybrid a little sportier looking and sportier feeling. You know, you've got black trim and, you know, things like that. And you can also get the hybrid powertrain in the titanium. But, you know, that mid-level one, you know, that's kind of the heart of the market. And Ford's actually, you know, projecting, you know, pretty significant take rate for hybrids in this new generation.
Yeah, well, and there's no reason, in some ways, there's no reason not to buy it. You know, it starts at 28.2. for the hybrid. And as you say, it's a sport edition. So it's, you know, it's engaging. It's an engaging drive. And if you have the opportunity to get access to an HOV lane, you're certainly going to get better fuel economy. And there's not.
Do you get the tax break? Can you still get the tax break?
No.
No.
No. You will be able to get a tax break with the plug-in when that arrives in the spring. So there's also a plug-in hybrid version coming in the spring.
Right. But some municipalities will still let a hybrid into the HOV lane. you know,
not in California.
Not in California. That's why I said some.
Yeah.
You know what? You just need a printer, right? You need a printer and you can print out one of those stickers and you can put it on the cut.
But anyway, okay. before
do that in California, you're looking at a pretty hefty fine.
Yes, that's true.
But no,
I think to the brig.
I think the Escape, they've done it. They have a nice range for somebody. And I would definitely consider the hybrid.
I think it's worth considering. I do still feel like the RAV4 is impressively updated as well. And I think I would have to crush up those two like back to back.
Yes,
to really
for
figure
sure.
Which one I like.
Yeah. I liked the hybrid. I liked the RAV4 hybrid a lot as well. And I thought the interior was a little bit spiffier. You know,
oh, really?
For the Toyota, I liked the bright blue pinstriping. I mean, it's just a personal thing, but yeah, I thought it was fair. Cool.
Because I really liked the interior here, except for like the door panels and stuff, where you start to feel like, okay, it's a $40,000 vehicle, but you can see some of the areas where they saved money.
Especially some of the lower panels, you know, like the sides of the center console. You know, you can definitely see where, you know, I mean, you know how in the past, you know, we've complained about the pricing on the Mazda CX-5.
Right.
But, you know, you get into a CX-5 and then you get into this and, you know, the upper areas of the interior, you know, they look, you know, pretty comparable in terms of materials and finish. But when you move down just a little bit, you know, you get, you know, to the sides of that center console. Now you're talking, you know, hard plastics that really don't look or feel as nice as the materials in the Mazda. You know, the Mazda definitely has a more upscale feel, even though, you know, it's, you know, about roughly the same pricing as the Escape.
Yeah, that's true. You know, see, this is Mazda's problem. We just talked about the RAV4 over and over again. Didn't mention the Mazda once.
And
it's
the same class. I would take the Mazda, you know, over the RAV4 any day.
Yeah, I can see that. That is a problem for Mazda to overcome. And while the Escape exists, I don't know that it's going to, because the Escape offers that sort of credible counterpoint to the RAV4 and to the CR-V as well, which is still out there. But the Escape I think overall styling wise, it's sleeker. It's the newest, of course, but it looks sleeker. It looks more premium just the way it's styled. And again, I had the sort of top trim, so that probably plays a role in how I feel about it. But it's, you know, it's sucking up some space in that market where the smaller players like Mazda may get lost. You know, because they're just not on the tip of everybody's tongue. We should do something to change that, but it's not our car company. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I think Mazda is going to start to feel a real challenge as well from Ford and, you know, from Toyota and Honda, is the lack of a hybrid in the CX-5. You know, and also, you know, plug-in hybrids. You know, Toyota just recently also announced that I think in LA next week they're going to reveal the plug-in hybrid version of the RAV4. So you're going to have plug-in hybrids from Ford and Toyota, plus regular hybrids and a hybrid from Honda, you know, and the CX-5 is, you know, it's got that diesel that is a not especially fuel-efficient diesel.
And, you know, diesel is just the star-crossed thing now. It's just, it takes so long to get here, and by the time it gets here, it's just not, I don't know.
Well,
and
I
don't think it's going to be a thing.
I think it's still a little bit tainted by Volkswagen. I mean, unless it's a truck.
Yeah, and it always will be, I think.
I know. Unless it's a truck, you know, I think it's really hard to sell it. Speaking of, I haven't read a lot, but I don't think it's out yet. The Jeep Wrangler diesel, the launch was last week. And
yeah,
so that'll be really interesting to see how that vehicle is received.
So far, I think I've seen chatter that reviewers like it. It's just expensive.
Yes, that was my impression.
Well, Wranglers are expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But, you know, next year, you know, in 2020, there's also going to be a plug-in hybrid Wrangler. So, you know, that gives, you know, yet another option there.
That just seems wrong. I don't know why. I don't know. Okay.
I did. You know what? Embrace it.
It'd be great.
You know. Think about it. You're out in the outdoors and the wild frontier. You know what could actually what could make more sense than if you've got a plug-in hybrid Wrangler with say 25 miles of electric range. You could be driving silently through the canyons and over the boulders, just on electric power alone.
Well, I think what would actually make more sense is if you save the electric power in the battery pack so that you can, heat your campfire or something, get some electricity out there. That's what I would rather do with that battery in a Wrangler.
Everybody needs to blow dry while they're camping.
No, I want like a space heater.
Oh, a space heater. Yes. That's why you have the fire.
Not in a tent. You don't.
No. Well, that's why you get one of those army surplus mummy bags.
Yeah. My idea of camping is a 3-star hotel. So no.
Okay. Well, look, I think that's enough for cars that we've been driving. We should jump into some of the stories we've been looking at. And because we've had our first snowfall, I think now is a really good time to talk about how Ford wants to expand the Mustang brand into a car that you could conceivably drive in all kinds of weather and get sort of your Mustang fix that way without crashing it into stuff.
You mean they're going to offer it with standard snow tires?
No, they're going to make basically an electric crossover that's Mustang inspired. And Sam, you actually have the most knowledge of all of us.
Most of which I can't share yet.
Right.
Because that's under embargo until Sunday. But by the time that this recording gets out and, just as long as this doesn't get published before 6 a.m. on Thursday.
How long do you want me to sit on it?
I suspect that you won't be ready before then. So 6 a.m. on Thursday is the embargo time.
I'm going to get it done tonight just for that. Out of spite. No, carry on.
last year, 2018, at the North American International Auto Show during Ford's press conference, they showed this teaser video, showing an Explorer and a Mustang driving through Detroit into the Corktown factory where Team Edison, the Ford EV team, was based. And, it gets struck by lightning, and then you see this flash come out, and then it ends showing the Mach 1 badge on there. And, Mach 1, for those who aren't Mustang fans, was a high-performance Mustang, in the late 60s, early 70s. I think usually with a big block V8, and people saw that, they said, no, this is wrong. You cannot call this thing the Mach 1. And, so Jim Farley and the team quickly backtracked on that. And, ever since then, they have been referring to this upcoming, Ford's first dedicated electric vehicle as the Mustang inspired electric SUV. And now officially it is no longer just Mustang inspired. It is actually a Mustang. They're an EV that's going to be revealed on Sunday. It's called the Mustang Mach-E. What do you guys think about calling this thing a Mustang?
I have thoughts, but I'll let Rebecca go.
Oh no, please. No.
Go. I think it's going to offend people, but I think it's also fine. If you're going to move, Mustang is a brand unto itself. And I think that expanding it is not a bad thing. It certainly, you get some of the affinity for Mustang. You've already got a name that's established. People know Ford Mustang. You don't have to sort of climb that hill of the Ford. What's that? So I think it's not a terrible move. I think they have to be prepared for some blowback.
Is nothing sacred anymore?
No, it's the car business. Nothing is
not
sacred
anymore. It's 2019. Nothing's sacred anymore.
You know what? They could just call it the Mustang and tell all those people.
There's a mid-engine,
you know,
Corvette now. Of course, nothing is sacred.
They could just call it what they want to call it and tell people, like, we own the name. It's our car company. Pound sand if you don't like it.
Well, what's kind of funny is that it's ironically, it's sort of like the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross. Like the Mitsubishi right. Eclipse was a little sports car for a long time.
Right. And there were enthusiasts and just people who remembered the Eclipse on when that thing launched. We were like, that's not an Eclipse.
Yes, exactly.
But, but there's a very important distinction here, though. Yeah. That Eclipse sports coupe no longer exists.
Yes.
You know, back in 1988. You know, we got word that Ford was going to replace the Mustang with a front-wheel drive coupe based on the Mazda 6. You know, and everybody got all up in arms about that. And, you know, they eventually backtracked on that, and that car became the Probe. But this time, you know, you have the Mach-E, but the classic Mustang, you know, coupes and convertibles, rear-wheel drive, V8 powered, those aren't going anywhere, at least not for the foreseeable future. Those are still with us, and they're going to be here. You know, so what's happening is they're expanding the Mustang brand into a family. You know, you've got everything from 4-cylinder EcoBoost Mustangs to the GT500.
So maybe it's more like the Ram then. I mean, maybe it's more like what Dodge is. You know, what Dodge did with Ram to make it its own brand.
It kind of is. You know, I mean, it's still a Ford. You know, so you're not completely separating it from the Ford brand, but you know, you're expanding it, you know, in a way, you know, I'd almost say it's more like what Toyota tried to do with the Prius, you know, a decade ago when they added the Prius V and the Prius C
Prime
and expand the Prius brand into a family. This is, you know, a little bit different, you know, but you know, and like I said, I can't discuss details yet of the Mach-E, but I think that this will be a much better fit, you know, as a Mustang than maybe some of the previous things, you know, compared to, you know, if they had called the Probe, if they had gone with their original plan for the Probe to be a Mustang, to be a replacement for a Mustang, you know, that would have been, I think, ultimately the death knell for Mustang. But, you know, because you're still retaining, you know, what Mustang is, and you're extending it into a new area, both with electric and a crossover, you know, I think that there's some interesting potential here. You know, and yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of Mustang traditionalists are not going to be happy, but you know, they're still going to have Mustangs to buy.
You know, here's the thing. I think the guys, I feel like the people who are those Mustang traditionalists.
It's mostly guys.
Yes, probably predominantly.
Yes, mostly but guys.
Those people who are going to be displeased that the Mustang name is being expanded to a model that's not typically a Mustang, they're sort of, they're the end of the curve, if you will. Those are people who are going to be dropping out of the market sooner than those who,
and you know, they're, let's face it. They're getting old.
Yeah. Right.
They're like me. They're getting old.
They're old school. Their mindset is
well,
old school.
No, and they're also getting old.
They're old school. They're getting old, but they're also like, there's a whole bunch of people who remember the Probe very fondly, would completely accept a front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive electric Mustang, no problem. And those are people who are already in or coming into the peak of their purchasing power. Ford's pretty smart to go find them with the product. And, you know, the Mustang isn't what it started off as anyway. It hasn't been since the last of the SN95 cars in 2004. You know, when that was the last Mustang that was based on a sort of economy car, you know, high volume car platform with big engines and affordable, it's still affordable, but you know, much lower price and sort of not as pure a sports car. Since the S197 in 2005, it's on its own platform. There's a lot of parts sharing, I get it, to keep the cost down, but it has become much more of a legitimate sports car than it ever was before. And so it's not what it was already.
I understand that. I think it's, first of all, I I see where it could be smart. You don't have to build a brand, right? Everyone knows. But right. I'm thinking back to a conversation that I had with Jim Farley like a year and a half, almost probably 2 years ago now, right after they made the announcement that they were discontinuing cars as we know them. And the definition, you know, how people perceive cars is evolving. And this is that evolution, right? I mean, people, we call everything a car, even if it's a truck-based SUV, people will still refer to it as their car. And it's, you know, we call a something like the Ford Escape, somebody's going to call that their car or a car. And so I think that how we think about cars and how the general public thinks about cars is evolving. And I think Ford is just following that evolution with the evolution of the Mustang nameplate. But it's still going to be, the uproar is going to be fun to watch.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a very interesting week.
They complained about the four-door Charger, like, oh, that's not a Charger. And then they bought all of them over and over and over again for the last 15 years or however long.
Of course they're going to buy them.
It's not going to be a problem. I think Ford probably is going to be able to sell these. I hope. And what do we know what it's going to be priced at? Can we talk about it?
No.
No and no. Okay.
No, yeah, but no and no. We can't talk about it and we don't know anyway, even if we could talk about it.
Okay.
They haven't said.
Okay.
But you know, keep this in mind, you know, that the idea of different form factors for the Mustang is not at all new. Yeah, I mean, going back to 19, you know, when I was working, you know, when I was still working in Ford Communications back in 2013, you know, and I worked on the press materials for the 50th anniversary of Mustang and the 2015 car. You know, I spent a lot of time in the archives, digging through the archives and finding, you know, images of, you know, some of the design concepts over the years, especially from the early years. And, you know, going back to 1963, you know, 62, 63, when they were developing the original Mustang, you know, there were design concepts, there were clay models and mock-ups back in 1963 of Mustang station wagons and Mustang sedans. You know, based on that first generation design. So, you know, the idea of trying something new with Mustang, you know, goes right back to the very beginning of this thing. So it's not at all a new idea.
Well, it actually sounds more like they had planned on having multiple body styles for the Mustang.
They did. Yeah. They certainly gave it serious consideration. You know, they never got around to producing it, but even, you know, over the years, you know, we went through, you had the notchback coupes, you had the fastbacks, you had the convertibles, you know, there were the hatchbacks through the, you know, Mustang II and you know, the Fox body era. So, you know, we went through a lot of different iterations of Mustang over the years.
Yeah, I think.
Let's look at it this way. At least it's not a Pinto.
Right.
That's a pretty low bar.
Well, I just love the whole,
I think people are actually going to be really pleasantly surprised with this thing when they see the details on it.
Yeah, I want to check it out. I think it's going to be great and it's going to be different and that's okay. Get over your clinging to the past. Come on, move on.
And, you know, if you want Ford to keep building, you know, traditional Mustangs, go out and buy them.
Yeah.
Buy more of them. If you buy them, they will build them.
Yeah.
You know, automakers stop building stuff when people stop buying them. As long as people want to pay the money, they'll build it.
Which is, you know, what astounds me is that we can vocally con them into bringing stuff here by saying we'll buy it, like the Chevrolet SS, for example, and then we just don't buy it.
Or the Cadillac CTS-V sport wagon.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like we were vocal enough to make it seem like there was a sales case. And then, no. Let's move on. Sam, you put in here de-icing of a Raptor because we saw it very briefly. There was an Autoblog post and the Berlin police don't mess around if you park the Raptor in the wrong place.
Yeah, well, you know, we've seen various reports over the, particularly over the last year or so, of people with big pickup trucks, especially big diesel pickup trucks, parking them in front of EV charging stations, just to be assholes. the latest iteration of this was somebody in Germany with an F-150 Raptor, and I can only imagine that usually when you see vehicles like this in Germany, they typically are being driven by members of the U.S. Armed Forces that are stationed in Germany, because they generally don't sell very many of these to German natives. But, in this particular case, somebody parked a Raptor in front of an EV charging station. So a tow truck was called, and this tow truck happened to have a crane on it. And they literally lifted up the Raptor and put it on a flatbed and took it away.
I think that's excellent.
And the aerial shots are pretty cool of it on Twitter.
Yeah. So do you guys understand why people feel the need to park their pickups in front of EV charging stations? Like, don't you have better things to do with your time?
Apparently not.
We're really going to get into the motivations of what people do here.
I don't know. Like, and I can't say here in like super liberal New England, I've seen it. I don't know if this is something that like I should keep an eye out for, or maybe only when traveling.
No, but it definitely happens. I mean, I think it happens a lot more, and this may be stereotypical, but in the South, I think it definitely happens a lot more.
Probably. But, then again, and I've talked about this before, in California, I've experienced EV drivers that just want to take advantage of, parking spots that are close to the store, parking their EVs at charging stations that are right next to a store and not plugging them in. Come on. What? If you're driving an EV, that people need to charge. If you're not going to use the charger, don't park at the charger. Park somewhere else and walk 100 feet to get to the store.
I know, but this is where we need to have those little robot chargers that like come to your car, and that will solve this problem.
I don't know about that.
I think we need to just hit those kind of inconsiderate owners with tasers.
No, yeah. but
like, I got some electricity for you right here.
I think if we do this, if we pick them up and put them on a flatbed, it'll solve the problem. If you start doing some of this here, that problem will kind of go away.
Yes, it will. But so will the mobile charging units. So they come out, they charge the car for you, and then they go back to their little spot. So the charging units are in this spot. You don't have to be in a specific spot.
I feel
spot.
Like there's a business for somebody who you just put like a GMC 471 on your flatbed, and you just drive around to get, and then you get a bunch of your buddies to block the chargers with their trucks, and you get that your 471 and your genset there, and so you're like, oh, you're kind of stuck, huh? I got a generator here. I'll charge you $25 an hour.
So basically, Tata, which owns Jaguar Land Rover, is looking for a partner because they need more partnerships. Specifically, they're talking to Geely and BMW. Geely, which owns Volvo, as we mentioned earlier, but they're based in China, and JLR is really losing their shirt in China. And so they need to figure out how do they manage demand there? How do they get product there? And this is a potential way to do that. And then on the BMW side, Sam, I think you mentioned that they already have a tie-in for electrification.
Yeah, they made an announcement back in May. It was in June of BMW and Jaguar Land Rover announcing a collaboration for their next generation electrification strategy. JLR was going to be using BMW's fifth generation electric drive technology. And right now, JLR only has, they've got a couple of plug-in hybrid Range Rover models, but they only have one battery electric vehicle, and that's the I-Pace. And, that one, they actually are not using they didn't develop their own electric powertrain for that. They went to AAM, a company formerly known as American Axle Manufacturing. And AAM provides the motors and gearboxes for the I-PACE. And those came out of a joint venture that AAM used to have with Saab. And after Saab went belly up, AAM bought those assets. And
so, American Axle was GM too, right? Like
it was spun out from GM back in the late 90s.
It's American Axle was GM, Saab was GM, so that's where the tie. Okay.
The tie up with Saab came long after American Axle was an independent company.
But it doesn't fit my conspiracy theory as well.
Okay.
Anyway.
Jaguar Land Rover's been looking for something, for more advanced technology, for their motors, for their electrification products, and potential tie-ups with BMW, and perhaps in China with Geely, would probably make a lot of sense for them.
I think it would, and also, I think one of the things that struck me about interesting with this is that just how we're seeing all of these potential tie-ups come to fruition in terms of, really kind of being brand agnostic in some ways. It's like, you have technology that we need. Maybe you can help us here. And there's no strange bedfellows anymore. Everyone needs to kind of tie in with somebody else, and whether they compete directly or not, it's just something, it's just the reality of today.
Yeah, well, we talked about this a little bit earlier this summer when Volkswagen and Ford announced their tie-up. But when you're doing electric vehicles, in the past, when everybody had internal combustion engines, their engines, tended to have a little more distinct character, from different manufacturers. A Jaguar inline six or V12 was a very different engine from, say a Mercedes V8, or an Audi five cylinder. They had very different sounds, very different characteristics. But as you move into electrification, a lot of those characteristics fall by the wayside. And, when you drive one EV, it really doesn't feel all that different from another EV. They all basically feel about the same. They don't make much sound. And to the degree that they make sound at all, it's usually something synthetic,
right?
Which, so there's less and less incentive for everybody to develop their own electric motors. And the same thing goes for batteries, and especially when EVs are still comparatively hard to sell. There's still a tiny segment of the market. Getting to economies of scale is really hard. And so, for manufacturers to tie up and share components, and share the development costs, for parts that don't make their vehicles, distinctly different from each other, makes a lot of sense.
No, it does. I mean, the way that you're going to differentiate yourself isn't necessarily with your exhaust note anymore, isn't with your powertrain technology. It's a different propulsion system, and it's a different emotional experience as well. So it does. I mean, if you can have the ability to spend the money and the time and budget on the interior, on the exterior, on the visual parts, because that's at the end is what's going to count in, 10 or 15 years when people aren't really driving as much anymore.
There's a totally missed opportunity too, where you can pipe those engine sounds in. You can buy them like ringtones. Come on, you could sell it.
Hey, actually, that is not at all a missed opportunity. That is starting to happen. Porsche, for example, is offering some optional different sounds for the Taycan.
Oh, that's so Porsche. We took it away, but we'll charge you extra to put it back.
And boy, are they charging you extra. I think it's like $500.
Oh, man. That's, yeah. But that, and so there's that. That's part of how you make it distinctive. But I think what we're seeing too is that we're at an early stage of this new motor, this new propulsion technology, sort of trying to go mainstream. And just like we had back in, say, the teens, 20s, and 30s with internal combustion engines, there were a lot of manufacturers that didn't build their own engines or transmissions. You know, they bought engines from Continental or, you know, Lycoming or, you know, some other manufacturer, and they bought other components and they assembled them. You know, there were a lot of assembled marks that didn't make it past the 30s with the economic downturn. So we're going to see a bunch of startups and a bunch of consolidation, and the motors and, you know, propulsion technology may get shared. There may be sort of independent motor companies, but then you'll see that consolidation start to happen. The companies that are going to stick around are going to stick, and they may well turn back to making everything in-house, like GM does with its own engines and Ford does with its own, right? Like, and their technology is going to have its own sort of secret sauce. Like, certainly Tesla makes its own motors and they do things differently than other motor manufacturers, and they get more efficiency out of the way they do it versus the way somebody else does it. So I think it'll shake out eventually. We'll see.
In time.
Time will tell.
It'll just be very tumultuous in the meantime.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, why don't we finish up with a couple of listener questions?
All right, that sounds good to me.
All right.
We had, what did we have? We had one via email and one via Twitter, so.
Yeah, so in email the other day, we got one from Peter Fagel in Germany, who asked, since we live in the times with the most expensive four bangers, including hybrids ever, I have two questions. First, am I right that the most expensive four banger, base price at least, is the Alfa Romeo 4C at $67,150? And two, why is only a four cylinder called a banger? Kind regards, Peter from Bavaria in Germany.
Okay.
All right. So I'll take the first part of that as far as the pricing goes. It's actually not the the Alfa 4C. It's, believe it or not, it's a Porsche. The 718 Boxster is currently the most expensive. It wasn't always, in fact, you know, fairly recently, it was not even, it wasn't the most expensive. It was the BMW 740e plug-in hybrid that up until 2019 had a 2-liter four-cylinder in there, and was base price was close to $100,000 for that one. The Boxster, let's see, the Boxster GTS, I think, is the most expensive four-cylinder Boxster, and it starts at $83,000 for the Boxster GTS, and you can run it up well over $100,000 for that one.
So,
wow.
I think if you were to adjust, you know, in inflation adjusted dollars too, I don't think this is the time of the most expensive four cylinder engines. I think that time was well back earlier in the early part of the 20th century with some very expensive luxury brands.
Oh yeah. And some very large displacement four cylinder engines.
Yes. So, like, let's just keep that in perspective. Like, yes, due to inflation and various other factors, the actual dollar amount right now is probably higher than ever before. But in terms of percentage of income and stuff, it's probably not the most expensive.
Yeah, that's true. Some of these models have actually moved away from four cylinders, like the BMW 5 and 7 Series plug-in hybrids for 2020. Have been updated with a six-cylinder engine, so they're no longer even available in that form. But you're right. In real dollar terms, over time, they probably were more expensive in the past. So you wanna handle the four banger question?
Sure. I will also point out that while four bangers seem like, you know, the only engine that we say banger, people commonly call one-cylinder motorcycles thumpers. So I think it's just just a colloquial sort of understanding. But I think four cylinders have that banger attached to it because they're not the most inherently smooth engine, especially an inline four, because you've got, you know, two sets of pistons. So at any point while it's running, two of them are going to be up, two of them are going to be down. That's a lot of mass, and it makes them bounce vertically. Whereas a six cylinder is very nicely balanced. There's more mass, obviously, but the mass is better spread out, so it's just inherently balanced. So they don't shake like that. Or a four cylinder always has a little bit of a shake in it. And so I think that roughness is how they got that reputation. And now we're in this age of very smooth four cylinders, which we didn't have back in the day when, you know, sixes and eights were a lot more common. The four cylinder felt a lot more agricultural because, it was, you know, that's a tractor engine. my Farmall Cub has a nice four cylinder, not my, you know, my Tempest or whatever. So yeah, there's at least in an inline and a flat four, because the mass is arranged differently. What is that? A second order?
Yeah, it's a second order imbalance.
It's not there. But for whatever reason, I never feel like a flat four is really any kind of more luxuriously smooth. It just has a different engine note to me, and that's about all. I don't know. They don't feel any smoother.
All right. Did you have any comments on that, Rebecca?
I'm good.
Okay. All right. I'll let you field this next one from Twitter from William Maley. Was there ever a news story or rumor that you first thought was a good idea, but then going the opposite direction the more you thought about it?
And he offered the example of Skoda coming to the U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I saw this earlier, and I was trying to think of them, and one of the things I thought of was, you know, maybe naming a car after a founder's son, but that seemed like a bad idea.
Wait, that happened.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, that didn't go so well, you know, that one time at Seoul. You know, I was trying to think of them. I mean, first of all, I you know, try and put out of my mind when I've been wrong. So that's one thing. Nothing jumped out at me right away. Do you guys have some?
I unfortunately can't think of anything because most of the bad ideas usually immediately struck me as bad ideas. So I'm having a hard time coming up with one that sounded like, that seemed like a good idea at the time. And then.
There's some current ideas that tend to focus on other market products, right? Like, how much have you seen people say that they really wish that Suzuki would sell the Jimny here in the US? And that's, it sounds like a great idea as an enthusiast. It's a terrible idea because it's small. It doesn't have the right power for this market. It's not going to feel refined enough. They wouldn't clear enough sales to make it profitable. Now, they would sell some, for sure, especially the first year, but they wouldn't sell enough in those ensuing years, and they probably wouldn't sell enough that first year to even sort of, you know, make any return on the investment. So that's a good idea that's actually a terrible idea. That's what I come up with.
Yeah.
I like it.
I guess, you know, maybe one idea that, you know, has kind of soured for me over the years, you know, is, you know, some of the stuff, you know, around, partially automated vehicles, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's, you
know,
yes.
You know, when we first got, you know, some of these, you know, things like autopilot and, you know, pilot assist and these various, partially automated systems, you know, they seemed like a good idea at the time. But the more I've thought about it, the more I've used these systems, the more I realize that, yeah, no, they're not a good idea. Not at all.
I got one.
Okay.
Touch screens.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
They're
a terrible idea.
I was going to ask Sam how you felt about them at first.
it seemed like, yeah, let's stick our tablets and our phones right on the dashboard. And then, you know, when you actually use them while you're trying to drive, you realize what a horrible idea that was.
I just want that thing right over there. You hit a bump and you hit the wrong thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So some would
say, or a trackpad on the center console.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Some would actually say also things, you know, like heads up display, which some people have a really hard time getting used to. And now that you can turn them off, you know, which is hugely beneficial, I think, to some people who are just not comfortable with it or they find it very distracting.
I suppose that people might find that distracting. God, I love a heads up
display. I love the heads up display.
I love HUDs too. You know,
once you get used to them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the main issue I've had with many of them over the years is, you know, just the way they've been executed, with, you know, often being fading away if you wear polarized sunglasses.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Yes.
That's true.
Not actually being able to see them.
And polarized sunglasses are the sunglasses you should use because they're the best.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
So,
all right.
Yeah, there's plenty of bad ideas. Those are just a few. So I think... this should be something that now we've answered, and now it's your turn, listeners, to chime in with your own. We'll see what you've got.
All right.
Yes.
Sounds like that could be very interesting.
All right. Well, so this is Wheel Bearings Podcast 130. We've made it to 130 episodes. You know where to find us online, and we'll catch everybody next week.
All right. See ya.
Thanks.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.